Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is the mad genius of poker, Mike Carroll. We'll be talking to Mike shortly. We received an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com from a listener who wants to know the best place to play blackjack in Las Vegas. Richard, this is yours.
Well, you know, that is a very difficult question because for many people, what do they mean by quote-unquote best? Now, in this particular case, he did get more specific about he comes to Las Vegas with a group of friends, and they're interested in two things. They're interested in a casino that has a good sports book and also full pay 3-2 blackjack that is not their experience on most of the nicer strip casinos is that those tables are $50 or $100 minimum. So they were looking for lower minimums and not the horrible rules that most of the Vegas Strip has gone to. I mentioned to him one possibility was the Gold Coast, and he said that they had looked at that and it was not sort of as nice as what they would like. They had tried downtown at the Golden Nugget, but the sports book really wasn't that big. So I think the best choice for that group, I told him to try out either Green Valley Ranch or Red Rock. Both of those places have, you know, full pay double deck games and quite nice sports books. So I think that'll work best for what it is they're looking for.
Very good. And probably by extension, the Palms could be on that list in a couple weeks, where the Palms is going to be taken over by the people who own the Station Casinos. And they have a nice sports book. And that's closer to the Strip and the other two are quite some distance from the Strip.
Do they still have a full sports book? Because they had that little kiosk, over near between the buffet and the coffee shop. But
yes, they have a full sports book over where it's always been. But they do have a substation near the coffee shops as well.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk to our guest. Mike Carroll, known professionally as Poker's Mad Genius, has been writing extensively on poker, statistics, ethics, and life. He's run tournaments, consulted with casinos and gambling periodicals, formed the Mike Carroll University. He currently lives in Missouri. Mike Carroll, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thank you, Bob and Richard. It's great to be here, gambling with an edge. We will gamble with an edge. We always try to, don't we?
Yes, some of us try harder than others. For the last dozen years or so, you've been a self-described hermit with relatively few interactions with others. You've recently decided to come out of your hermit crab shell, so to speak, and re-enter the real world. Now, what's this all about?
Well, you have that a little bit backwards. I was in the real world, and now I'm stepping back into the contrived world a little bit. I've been doing a lot of research for the last dozen years or 14 years or so. I kind of left poker when it was right in the most spotlighted part that I've ever seen it, and so my sudden departure probably surprised some people, but I still have done, you know, seminars along the way. I've gone to Trinity College. I've done three or four seminars in Florida, but basically I try to just commune with the furry creatures in the forest, and those are my friends. So, but when you're surrounded by computers, as I am, on every side of me, then you you can still communicate with the world and be a hermit at the same time. So it's not like Thoreau. It's like modern age hermitages.
Huh.
Does that allow Does that allow you to play poker at all, or no?
I don't play at all. When I go do a seminar, I do courtesy play in the casinos. I played a few times in the main event at the World Series of Poker while I've been a hermit. I actually did 6 seminars at the 2009 World Series, I believe. I think ESPN did a long profile of me then. And that was gratifying. But other than that, I haven't made any appearances at all.
And what prompted that change?
I always wanted to be on a forest. I mean, on a lake with a forest surrounding me and all the creatures. I put in 6 miles of golf cart paths. I've since moved from that location, by the way. And I'm living with Diane across the lake. But on the same lake, and where my boat slip was anyway, so I'm still on the lake, but I am down to 4.6 acres now instead of 40 acres, so now I can't get as lost in the forest as I was. But I love the lifestyle. It's just getting away from the big city environment. It was just something I always wanted to do, decided to do, scouted the internet for the right location, actually bought the location sight unseen, moved in, and didn't associate. I was totally antisocial, and that's the Mike Carroll story. The mad genius of poker doesn't like people anymore.
Different subject. 20 or so years ago, you were promoting the idea of 4 colors in poker, where diamonds, I think, were blue instead of red. I personally thought this was a great idea and tried to promote it in video poker and with very limited success. Do you think the idea of 4 color poker decks is completely dead, or it's an idea that'll come around pretty soon?
Well, it'll eventually come around. There's no doubt about it. It's coming around to most of the online card rooms offer 4 color decks, and I would think they should do it by default. There's a great resistance to change. When we did tried to get the poker community to move to 4 color decks, we actually did it in 65 casinos worldwide at the same moment, in the same hour, the same time, and we found that about almost 80% of the people preferred the 4-color deck, but about 20% were screaming their heads off. You know, as soon as you lose a pot, then it's the fault of the 4-color deck. It's the most natural thing in the world. It's not an original idea with me, obviously. I would assume it was the first idea for a deck, that there should be differentiating colors for each suit. Why not? It's the most natural thing, but I think what happened was printing costs. In those days, it was too expensive to use 4 discrete colors, and so they ended up for a while using just 2, so your hearts and your diamonds were red and your clubs and your spades were black. I think that was just by necessity and not by choice. So it's the most natural thing. No, it's not dead. It's going to happen, and people will give me some credit for doing it, and I shouldn't get any credit at all because it was probably the very first idea. That's probably how it started.
Yeah, I certainly prefer it. I don't understand.
Well, it makes it easier. You don't have to take a second look to see what the flushes are, right? So why not 4 colors?
Right.
I'm glad you prefer it too. I'm that you join the family. Thank you for saying that. Now I don't feel so horrible.
Your books and DVDs on Poker Tales are classics in the poker literature. On this show, we've had Zachary Elwood a few times, and he's written several books of his own on Poker Tales. Do you plan to write any more on this subject? Perhaps a book about Poker Tales in a world where all competent players have read Mike Carroll's book on Poker Tales.
Yeah, the first part of that question, I guess it was all one question, but it's in two discrete parts as far as answering it. So answer the first part of the question. Yes, I do, actually. The next book actually goes beyond Tells. It's called Professional Poker Play-by-Play, Tells, Psychology, and Manipulation. Tells, Psychology, and Manipulation. I weave them all together. And the second part of that is what would happen if everybody all knew these tells. That's a good question. We're these tells, which what we call tells, really don't damage players unless they're against somebody who's astute. In other words, somebody tries the fundamental force behind tells is that players instinctively try to act strong when they hold weak hands and try to convey weakness when they hold strong hands. Because you can't show your poker cards, so you always try to act in a way that's opposite the strength of their hands. That gives you an opportunity to pick up tells. Are they acting weak? And we give all kinds of ways how players try to act weak. Or are they trying to act strong? There's a lot of indications of that. And so the premise is that they're usually, when they're bothering to act, they're trying to fool you. And that's true. But the question is, are they really damaging themselves by doing that? The answer is no. They're probably doing a good thing. In other words, if they reverse a tell, they'll probably make less money by reversing a tell because most people aren't astute enough to know what the tell should be. So that's the problem with everybody picking up on tells and trying to reverse tells. So no matter how much they reverse tells, even if they all knew the same tells, they knew what they are, the fundamental thing would still be true, that they're still trying, no matter what level of trickery or sophistication they get to, and no matter how much other players know that they know the tells, they're still trying to project weakness if they're strong, and they're still trying to project strength if they're weak. So they may go to a different level of doing that. It may muddy the waters. It may be much more difficult for some people to figure out what they mean, but the fundamentals are still there. Strength means weakness. Weakness means strength.
But if your opponent knows that, then can't they just act the opposite? And if they start picking that
then the opposite becomes the tell, doesn't it?
Well, right, but yeah. Well, so it really sort of elevates.
So if you knew your opponent knew you're looking for a certain tell, and then they reverse it, then the reverse is what the original tell was. So in any case, why would they be doing that? They're doing that to reverse it, so they're still not trying to perceive that you would think, let's say they're acting strong now with a strong hand, thinking that you think they should be acting weak. Well, now that's a tell in itself, isn't it? They're still trying to deceive you by acting in a certain way that is directly opposite of the strength of their hand. And, by the way, that actually happened. I had a player come in a game, a really polite Japanese kid in Gardena, California. We were playing cards. He comes in, and he plays sensible poker, and he gives me two tells. I pick up on them wrong both times. Of course, usually after you see a reverse tell once, you're immediately suspicious. But anyway, he got me twice and acknowledged me not at all for the whole time, but very polite. Ended up winning a lot of money, got up from the table and said, "Nice to meet you, Mike Carroll. I enjoy your book." He was doing exactly what you're talking about. He was actually doing that against you. So, but had he continued that, it wouldn't work anymore, would it? Because We now have somebody who's reversing tells. So, yeah, I guess you could con a person once or twice. At least he was able to con me twice. So, there you go.
Right.
I
left you. This is we're running into dead air only because I'm leaving you speechless, right?
Yeah, and I can always cut out the dead air, so don't worry about that.
All right. So we're 6 weeks before presidential election. About every day on your website, poker1.com, where the one is a digit, not spelled out.
Yeah.
You post presidential odds.
I do.
And we're taping this show a couple days before it's posted, and things can change, but you showed Trump at almost a 3-2 favorite.
Not quite.
And
right.
538.com, which is also a highly respected website and not known to be slanted either way, has Clinton a favorite by approximately the same amount. This
well,
is 538.com
tended to hit the state-by-state almost on the head. He hit that nail on the head last election, so has a lot of credibility and does a lot of scientific research. My odds are different than that. We're actually taking advantage of everybody's knowledge, and then I'm projecting how I believe that the flow of things will go, how people react. I'm trying to put the chain of events together. Where is it more likely to go? What events are more likely to influence other events? And down the line, as we get closer and closer to the election, so I'm not just looking at a lot of times when I have Trump favored. That doesn't mean I think Trump would win today. I just think that the events are trending in that direction, and I think it's actually bearing out in recent events, as he is probably at least dead even now, and maybe even. Momentum is taking him to the lead. I think the big advantage Trump has is that he's been painted as so uncivilized, which I think some of that he's brought on himself, but that if he shows up at the debates and looks a tiny bit presidential, people will think, well, in the way we expected him to be. And therefore, Clinton has a bigger burden in those debates in that she has to maintain that demeanor as being vastly superior. Otherwise, people are going to think that Trump is perhaps an acceptable alternative. And then the 13-20% of the voter base that are on the top and can be shaken loose still. Would tend to fall more in his direction. So I think that's one of the big advantages. And we'll know, you could see those odds. And by the way, my odds are not doing, there's a very good chance that Trump could win the popular vote and lose the Electoral College. And
or
I'm
the other way around.
I'm only doing that, that is only the popular vote odds. So we're not messing with the Electoral College at all. And the reason I don't do that is because most of the models that do the Electoral College are just all screwed up. They are actually they're messed up, not because they have bad information, because they're using a bad paradigm. They're taking essentially. Here's how a lot of them do it. They take each state, they get the latest information on how likely it is that that state will go one way or another. And a lot of times that information is very old. There's no polling or something, so it's just a guess. But you take that percentage. And now you can just randomly go through a computer and say, okay, 32% of the time this state is going to fall this way, so let's just do a Monte Carlo simulation. And that doesn't take in – those are always wrong, because if one state that was only a 32% likelihood ends up winning – then it means there is an implied indication that the other states would fall as well. And that's why I don't have enough knowledge, enough sophistication, enough link to sources to do an Electoral College map. So I'll leave that to other people. But they are making a mistake in that regard.
I'm confused about the very first part of that. The part where when you have Trump as a 3-2 favorite, you base that on what exactly?
That's Mike Carroll. That's Mike Carroll's perception of just sitting down, taking the trends. How much will this event hurt? Where is it likely? We're only measuring the popular vote now. We're not trying to say who's going to be the president. We're only doing the popular vote. That's the only odds. Saying right now, as of today, which is a couple days ago, when this is broadcast, that it was 59.1% that Trump would end up ahead in the popular vote versus Hillary Clinton, not considering events where neither one of them make it to the finish line. So that's what I'm saying. How do I come to that? I come to that just by using everybody else's information and using Mike Carroll's projection on where things are going or how. Basically, it's the same kind of thing you do in poker. How likely is somebody to be bluffing? How likely is the other to have a strong hand? Well, how likely is this blunder, which is being played up in the media right now? For instance, just a little item I just added, which is going to be totally insignificant. Donald Trump Jr. Just recently tweeted that it was like the immigration problem, letting all the immigrants from Syria into the country without proper vetting, in his mind, is similar to taking, what if you knew that the bowl of Skittles had three bad ones and you would die if you got one, would you eat a handful of them? He said, and people are saying that's a horrible analogy. It's actually a very good analogy when you think of it, because what he's saying is, along with a lot of very good people, you'll be letting in some bad ones. Are you willing to gamble on that basis? Well, that's the analogy he made. Okay, so now the press is going crazy with that. I don't know why. It seems like a stretch, but they are. Okay, so how much is that event likely to influence the election? Probably not at all, unless it springboards into something else. How likely is it to springboard into something else? Not very much. How likely is it to die because it's like a ripple and other effects are coming along and you won't even hear about it, won't even stick in people's mind to any meaningful degree? So we got that X'd out as a 0.0002, I think. So it's gotten no effect. All these things have effects. But what if it did resonate? What if that one thing, that little thing that is a nothing right now, did resonate for some reason? And unless there's some story comes up, Donald Trump Jr. actually said that and used Skittles because he has racist tendencies, which come out in this proven letter that he wrote to his girlfriend in 1999. Okay, now it becomes a story, and it goes on. And not that I'm saying any of that's going to happen, and that's not true, and it's just a weird example based on nothing, and it has nothing to do with racism, but let's just say it had. Then it would become a story, then it would project, and then the entire odds would change, whereas they won't now. And that's what we do. We take every little thing that happens that I know about, some of them probably slip by, and try to put them into a big picture, see how one thing influences another and where it's likely to lead. So it's not a snapshot of where the election is right now. It's a projection of what the final odds will be on election day.
Right. Well, it seems to me, I mean, because we're a show geared toward gamblers, you know, it seems to me that you know, if you believe that, you know, Trump has a 59% chance of winning and you can get, you know, 3-2, it seems like that would be, in your mind, an awfully good bet to be able to bet.
It would be right now. It's not nearly as good as it was, though, is it? Trump was 4-1 or a little bit more than that in some places not long ago. I mean, Trump was 4-1 against Trump. So 20%. So it's certainly you see how those odds and my odds are starting to come together. they've moved significantly in that direction. I'm saying that it depends on how the next debate. The next debate is a big event. Trump could fall to like 30% or less after the first debate, or he could go up. So he has a margin to fall a lot more than he could go up. No candidate until the very last debate can possibly be much more than 70%. By the way, that's an impossibility. So when you saw the ones with Clinton at 80%, that was an impossibility. It was a mathematical impossibility, because the debates themselves, certainly, if you were to play out these in history, they certainly have the propensity to change the final outcome by much more than that. So it could not have been 80%. It could never have been 80%. It could only have been 80% at that moment in time, because other events certainly could dramatically change the race in either direction.
All right, well, let's get back to poker.
Okay.
All right. Okay, go ahead, Richard.
No, go ahead, Bob.
Shortly before the election, there'll be the final table of the main event, World Series of Poker.
Yep.
For someone interested in learning about poker, is watching the final table play out a good use of your time?
Well, yeah, if you want to identify mistakes. I tutor by Skype a lot of times, so I take students and we actually watch. We use advanced poker training to play remotely, watching, sharing the screen by Skype. And in doing that, we watch all the cards, and we let the computer expose the cards of the opponents after the hand and ask what mistake, and we try to estimate, I estimate for them, how much this player made a $72 bet here, let's say. How much value did he get for that bet? Let's say it's $57. Well, then he made a $15 mistake. Same thing. And so what's the total of mistakes? And is the total aggregate of mistakes divided by the number of opponents worse or better than the mistakes you're making? So that's the only way you make a profit in poker, is that it's a war of mistakes. The person who makes the least mistakes makes the most money. So that's the only way to measure profit. It doesn't matter that you're the best player in the world. And I'm going to answer your question, by the way, don't worry. It doesn't matter if you're the best player in the world or almost the best player in the world or the 20th. Let's say you're the 20th best player in the world and you play against the top 9 opponents in the world, you're going to lose money. But you could be the 20 millionth best player in the world and play against all the weakest players you can find, and you'll be a professional. So it's the difference between your skill and the amount of mistakes you make versus the amount of mistakes your opponents make that matters. That's the only measurement that will translate to profit. Now, when you watch the World Series of Poker, I've watched a few of them. It's just a war of mistakes. It's who's going to make the most mistakes. None of these hands, very few hands, are played logically. It's just a total war of, it's very discouraging to think that they're playing that poorly, hand after hand. But that's my impression of it. You asked the question, I gave you my answer.
And what do you find to be the biggest mistakes that you see people consistently making?
Well, they've drunk the Kool-Aid. They've decided that this new poker, you know, they say the old poker is out of style. It doesn't work anymore. Well, that's ridiculous. If somebody had bothered to analyze poker scientifically, how often you should raise in a given situation, how in 1850, when it was just starting to evolve, and the hold'em had been around then, which it wasn't, then the answers that you derived, if they were done correctly then, are no different than they are in 2016 today. They're no different. It never changes. Those answers can never change. There is no such thing. It's not like putting it on a new suit, or that bell bottoms went out of fashion and now this is what people are wearing this year. That doesn't work. It's the same answers. The things that were true then are true now. And people make the mistake of saying, yeah, but people are going over the top now. They're going an extra raise, or they're going an extra two raises. So what? If you just, what they don't understand is, yeah, you can adapt to that and make money and really take money away from people who are playing incorrectly by going too many raises. Of course you can do that. But you don't even have to. If you just play the same basic style and never adapt, no matter what your opponents do, and your opponents err by either betting too frequently or not betting enough, then there's a built-in profit. You do not have to adjust to opponents. You will make money by not adjusting, but you can make even more money if you do adjust and you do it rationally. That's what they're missing. Now, what's really happened is there's become an epidemic of raising. People are just bluffing and raising and seeing which garbage hand can out-garbage the other. And this is just silly. So if you just put in somebody who was skilled in the rudimentary aspects of poker and put him in those games and played, you know, forever for a long, it wouldn't take too long to gather all the money. They're just incorrect. They're just totally incorrect. I heard an announcer the other day on one of these shows say, well, that would have worked in 2012, but it won't work now. That's ridiculous.
Well, it would be really interesting to see to see that tested, you know.
You don't need to test it. I've already told you. I've given you the answer. We do not need to test it. When Mike Carroll gives you an answer, we do not need to test it. It's a law of nature.
Well, yes, but we don't know what optimal is, right? We don't know the exact. I mean, in limited poker, we do.
In heads-up limit poker.
Yeah, in heads-up...
Multi-way poker, nothing changes. What are the... I could tell you the... Let's see, here's a, I think, a definitive guide I have here to hold'em hands. It's a very basic, most conservative guide to all the hands that we know to be profitable. So these are the hands that were profitable to play from which position in 1850, had there been hold'em there, which there wasn't. And then it's the same hands today. So if somebody just sticks to that, then they're playing starting hands better than the people playing new poker. It can't be true. It's an impossibility that poker theory can change. There can be advancements. What am I, you know, I deal with millions of hands from a databases, from gathered combined databases of real online sites. These aren't the ones you see online, but the actual, because of my consulting with online sites. So I actually know what, not, I don't know who the players were, but I know what the hand results were. These aren't the ones where you don't get, like online, where you don't see what the other players' cards were. I can see all the cards. So I deal with that. What do I see? I see that on the aggressive poker where they try to out-bull each other through the pots to try to take command, and it's a war of aggression, I see that they all lose money. But why don't they know that they lose money? Why do they? How many new poker players do you know that are actually making money? Not too many. And not too many old poker players either, not in the old style, because people don't do it correctly. But what is the fundamental truth here? The fundamental truth is that they're winning a whole lot of pots. They're succeeding in taking the pots. They're succeeding in taking the pots, and yet in poker, what is the one thing you don't want to do? It's win a pot. You do not want to win pots in poker. People obviously have the wrong idea. They think the object of poker is to win pots. Well, all throughout the history of poker, the players who win the fewest pots are usually the big winners, and the people who win the most pots are the big losers. And you can almost prove that very simplistically by saying if you wanted to be the world champion of winning pots, all you'd have to do is raise and bet all the way to the river, and you'd either win in a showdown or you would win prematurely before the showdown, and then every single hand you could win, you would win. You'd be the world champion of winning pots, but you'd lose all your money. The object of poker is not to win pots, it's to make correct decisions. So what these people are doing is they're just finding ways to be assertive, aggressive, and they're winning a lot of pots because opponents are throwing away the best hand against him again and again. But that's fine because the bottom line is that they don't win enough pots so that the times they find themselves in a big confrontation, they don't lose it all back. Of course, all these plays lose money. I've left you speechless.
I actually, you know, my background, I come from a blackjack background, and I've for 35 years found
well, then, the then you know the perfect, and you know you're dealing with blackjack, and I knew you were, by the way. So you're dealing with absolute decisions there. There is no
correct
variation. So,
that,
so
right.
blackjack is an ultimate. If poker is just the same game as blackjack, I mean, in essence, except that it gets confusing to people. They don't see that there's one basic play that wins, and there's nothing you can do to vary it to say, okay, I'm gonna do this different one time in 20 or something like that differently. It doesn't matter. In blackjack, you might do that to try to keep the casino off your trail, or you know, to as a red herring. But other than that, the best strategy is known. Well, the best strategy in poker is also known. So that's a very good example.
Yeah, I just have always found it amazing that, you know, that these very famous poker players go broke all the time. It just, you know, to blackjack players, that's anathema to us, you know.
Well, I think when I left the Ozarks, a lot of the, I think about five of them on the top of the list, winners actually owed me money. So yeah, that's a secret in the poker world that it's hard to cover all those expenses. And of course, the ones who win tournaments are usually getting lucky, and then whether or not they'll continue to be at the top over years, it usually turns out not to be the case, right? The names keep changing. It's like a revolving door. It just you don't know what you're going to get from which panel is going to slap you in the face next time. But it's so there are basically just names who people think for a short time are the top of the world, and very few of them remain there. Some do, though. Some do,
yep.
And those are probably the really good players.
Now, there are some other controversial stances that you have. One of the articles you wrote is entitled, Poker Rules Players Argue About, But I'm Right. Can you tell us about that?
I don't remember which rules I talked about, so I really can't. You're talking about something that the rules I think that should be, I think cards speak should be a rule. I think one of the rules that I have that has kind of made its way throughout poker over the years, I put in a rule book that I wrote in the early 1970s, and it's to keep people from angle shooting. It's and you see a variation of this in almost every rule book today. Says management, something like this. Management reserves the right to make decisions that are clearly in the best interest of the game, even if an exact interpretation of other rules would dictate a contrary decision. What that does is keep people from using the rules, you know, as a weapon instead of in the way that they're intended.
Yeah, one of the things that they came up with in online poker that was for the good of the game that a lot of people got pissed off about was this idea of anonymity of the players. so that you couldn't have these databases of thousands of hands that your opponent has played where you can see, you know, how they've played over the course of their career on that site. A lot of the professionals were upset about that rule.
Well, I'm against heads-up displays. I think they're there, so I'll go along with them. I would even endorse them if they were available to all sites. Some sites allow them and some sites don't. And if your listeners don't know exactly what Richard is talking about here, you're talking about the software that does the tracking of opponents for you, flashes it up on top of the screen when you're playing against that opponent, how often they've done this, how often they've done that. That would be fine if everybody, I don't think you should have to buy that separately. If you join a site, it should be included. They can make a deal with the companies, and then everybody has the same advantage. I don't really think buying an advantage makes much sense in these poker games. And it also makes it a different kind of game than you would play in real life. So, and especially if you have to smuggle those into the sites because the sites are trying to keep you from using them, then I have a big objection to their use.
I think you want to, I mean, new players coming into the game, you want to encourage that. And if players are using those tools, the new players are just going to get slaughtered.
Right, and then, I don't think that's good for the game. Experienced players may get slaughtered too if they don't use that.
Because
then they'll be against players who are using it, and they'll be at a tremendous disadvantage. So you've kind of started a war of balance of power here, where it's almost a necessity. I've actually never used a heads-up display, but I've had them demonstrated for.
Yeah, but if you just anonymize the players, well, then there is no, you know, that tool no longer exists because there is no history.
Right, and that's what you were saying originally, is that just by anonymizing the players, they have no or having them just randomly get into a different table with no history of who they are because they have a different name and they're essentially anonymous, that protects against that. That's true.
One of the rules you mentioned that you really like is card speak.
Yeah, I like card speak.
And you also
like card speak because people get confused about when you say if you declare a bet, or you just he said he raised, he said he folded. No, he didn't. I said I wanted a glaze on my donut. Oh, you know, you get in all these arguments. Just, and people would say, well, then they'd be misleading. People would be reacting to what they said, and they wouldn't hold their cards, and that would be an angle shot. Not very long, for about 30 minutes, once you understand that only the cards that are shown actually speak or indicate what they are, then you wouldn't have that problem. I'm talking about not card speak. That's according to a showdown, not saying what you have. But I'm talking about action speak also. Only your action speak. Did you put money in the pot in a limit game, for instance? Did you put money in the pot or you didn't? No, he said he was going to raise. Well, but no, I didn't mean to say I was going to raise. Well, you don't have to raise. If you put money in the pot, it's a raise. If you don't, you don't. Somebody throws away out a turn, they'll quickly learn not to do that. Well, what's the advantage of that? The advantage is that everybody in the world can immediately understand the rules of the game. That doesn't matter what you say. What are some of the other bad rules? I'll tell you, the worst rules in poker are the ones they put in that Jack McClellan actually told me privately. They actually were talking about me when they put this rule in. You can't talk about you can't tell the truth about your hand in a poker game. That's ridiculous. I want to tell the truth about my hand. I want to do it in exactly the ratio that will most confuse my opponents, so that they'll wonder if everything I say has to be
false.
It has to be a lie. And yeah, if it's false, then I can say, well, if I say I don't have aces, then I have to have aces, right?
Let's go back to chip speak, where you, Richard, and I are playing limit hold'em.
You have to make an exception for no limit for big bets.
All right.
Okay, go ahead.
We're playing limit hold'em. You, me, and Richard, of which I really don't like my chances in this game. But we're down, and I don't have many left. You make a bet that would, a limit bet, but it would put me all in.
Okay.
I say, I call, turn my cards face up. I have not moved the rest of my chips, but I do say I call and put my cards face up. Okay. Both you and Richard clearly understood what I said. Would you say I have made a bet or have not?
Not, but you other rules could, if you were doing that as an angle, your hand could be dead. Potentially, because you've exposed your cards out of turn. And that's where my great rule of poker comes in, where the management comes over and makes an interpretation in the best interest of the game, whether or not it should be a dead hand or not. But no, I don't. I think saying I call means nothing. I call means nothing. In that case, I would think that if it were not a sophisticated player who is not trying to shoot an angle, then I would certainly rule, and it would seem obvious to me that he meant to call, turned his hand over. If he turned his hand over, let's say he turned his hand over, let's simplify this, and there's no action possible at that point. There's no more action possible. It's the turning the cards over that's confusing this situation a little in my mind. But let's say he's last act. He says call and turns his cards over. He's not obligated to put the money in my opinion, should not be. He is in all traditional poker rooms that I know of right now, because that's how they rule it. Well, if you either put your money in or you don't. Once you put your money in, then it's a bet. Now there's no confusion. That's what I'm saying. Yes, it's radical. Yes, it's not popular. Yes, it's controversial. And yes, it's right.
All right. So we are going to, we're talking to Mike Carroll of Poker's Mad Genius. We got a few more questions for him, but before we do that, we have a few commercials. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anyone else has. Every Thursday in September, 25 people get to spin the wheel in the $500,000 Big Spin and Win promotion. If your name is called over the loudspeaker, which may be heard all over the casino, you have 4 minutes to make your way to the showroom. The wheel has prizes of $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, and $25,000, with an average of $4,250. After each week's drawing, you may begin to start earning tickets for next week's drawing. Each day, there's a maximum of 1,600 tickets available for you to earn, $1 per ticket for video poker, $1 for 4 tickets for reels, midnight to midnight. All right, next week's free video poker classes, Wednesday, September 28th at noon, is Pseudo-NSU Deuces Wild Ultimate X. This is the 15.9443 version of Deuces Wild, and in 10-play Ultimate X, it returns 99.44%, which can be good depending on the slot club and other promotions. Although it's certainly not at the advanced level, it's not a beginner class either. It's presumed that the students know basic NSU Deuces Wild at least the recreational level. At the Palms, from now to the end of December, they have drawings Saturday night, 7:15 p.m. Winners share $10,000 each night. Every day between Monday and Friday, you swipe to earn 20 free additional tickets. PFP, Play for Prizes, Monday through Friday from now until September 30th. You earn TJ Maxx gift cards. Prizes are redeemed at a rate of 0.2%, up to $190 per day. You keep the points. Station casinos will be taking over the Palms in early October, at which time the casino will no longer be a sponsor of the show. We're looking for additional sponsors this time, so if you have a product you think will be of interest to APs or want to be APs, please get in touch with us. At VideoPoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold Membership, $8.95 a month, or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the game. The game of the week is 100 Play Spin Poker. Spin Poker is a 6 coins per line game, where approximately every 15 hands you receive a multiplier between 2x and 10x. No change in strategy is required, and the Super Times Pay feature adds approximately 0.25% of value to the play. All right, we're talking to Mike Carroll, poker's mad genius. Now, 15 years ago, I was writing for Casino Player magazine, and you began an association with him. This was great in my opinion. The general levels of columnists in that publication was not very impressive, and your presence immediately increased the seriousness of the magazine. You wrote an article about the essence of poker, comparing it to cow dung. And these included three things. First, there must be something of value to fight over before the betting begins. Second, the exact value of your holding a secret, known to you but not your opponents. And third, the last bet, if it isn't voluntarily matched by anyone, then the player who bet wins all the money automatically. Now, your point is, if a game has these three features, it's poker, whether it has cards or not. If it doesn't have these three features, it's not poker. When I read this, my reaction was, don't you need a set of rules and a way of keeping score? Somehow you need to be able to compare holding A versus holding B to determine which one is more valuable. Isn't that a necessary element to poker as well?
Yeah, I use card chips as a cow chips. You go out in the pasture, you take a brown paper bag out there, and you try to find a, I guess it has to be a large bag, find the biggest cow chips, chip you can find, and come back at the table with the ante already in place, and now you bet about who has it, and you could win even if your bag were empty. Let's say it didn't have anything in it. On a bluff. So that would be in keeping with the nature of poker. And what you're saying is, well, with cards, you have a perfect way, a flush piece is straight, a higher flush piece, a lower flush, two pair beats one pair, three of a kind beats two pair, and so forth. And so there's no argument about the size. So I think that's a very good point. But I was using that as an example. That you really didn't need cards. Of course, you need a precise way of weighing the hands, so you'd need a precise way of weighing the cow chips that you found in the pasture, maybe a scale, that's very precise or something like that. I guess you'd have to compare cow chips that way. It's easier to compare poker hands with cards, so I agree with you on that.
Andy Block was a guest on our show a couple years ago, and
okay.
he had won a rock, paper, scissors contest.
Okay.
As far as he was concerned, rock, paper, scissors was poker without cards. And
well,
so
Poker Without Cards is the name of my book, by the way, which I announced in 1995, I believe, and ran with third page ads for about 6 months until I decided not to put it on the front burner. So Poker Without Cards is the name of my book. But yeah, it is. So that is kind of poker without cards, but you can't bluff.
Yeah, and exactly. There's no betting element in that's
right.
What's missing.
It's one bet, you can't bluff. So you've already made your bet. So it has the aspect of poker, Andy's right. It has an aspect of poker in that you're trying to get inside your opponent's head and do whichever one of those three conquers whatever one of those three that he, rock, paper, scissors, that he's going to do. So I really don't think it's a poker-like game, but I can see that there might be aspects of that, and Andy is, you know, that's fascinating that Andy said that, and I will take it under consideration.
Now, you're aware.
He isn't going to beat me at it, I know that. He might bring me to a draw, but I'm going to be calculating all the time their tendencies to follow one with another.
Well, as you pointed out earlier, if you play Game Theory Optimal, then the best he could do would be to draw.
Well, of course, because then everything would be totally random from that moment on, not based on what happened before, but totally 33.33% at all times. That's application of game theory to that situation is very trivial. It's just, you just randomize every time.
But actually doing that randomization as you're doing it quickly is potentially tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. I do this experiment with students sometimes. Put these cards in a random order. Here are 20 cards. Yeah, and you can see, I actually wrote a program back in the 90s for a dealer contest to see which decks were actually shuffled the most randomly. I used that for a sub-application of people trying to put things in random order. Well, they tend to do a very poor job of it. Even if you were just, say, put a sequence of heads and tails in random order, and now go, talk. Heads, heads, tails, heads, tails, tails, heads. And they're going to try to, even though they're going to see that there are little mini streaks, they're going to try to equalize more often than they should. After six heads, the next one is going to be a tails more often than it really would be. And it wouldn't be 50-50 anymore. Yeah, people, you're absolutely right. Brilliant point. People do not randomize very well in their heads.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I remember reading that book about Andy Beal, who came to play, you know, the highest poker I think anyone's ever played. You know, he played a lot of the top pros in Vegas, and his idea was to randomize his actions, and he had some method. I don't remember if he had a watch or something that he was using to randomize his length of time to make decisions.
Sure, I know about that, but I don't know about the randomization. This year, this is the first I heard about that. But the you can randomize. You should randomize decision, like you might want to bluff. Let's say you're going to bluff a quarter of a time. Well, you might as well. You could, as David Sklansky has suggested, look at your watch and see where the second hand is. I like to say, you can divide cards into different combinations of the first card and the second card, whether the suit times suit, 16 different combinations there. But just look at your first card. If you're going to do something 25% of the time, do it when the first card is a club, for instance. That makes it real easy, and then you're not going to get off very far from what the random number should be. But I personally never do that because basically I'm making my decisions when they're very close. If they're borderline and you have to go one way or another, I'm making those decisions. I'm always looking for more information, so I'm looking at the psychology of the game. I'm going to focus more if a decision is borderline on what trips it over one side or another. You know, what is my opponent actually trying to imply? So now you get tiny tells, micro tells come in, tells that mean very little and are probably not very accurate, but maybe 51 or 52% accurate. That's enough to trip a totally borderline decision over one way or the other.
Makes sense?
Of course it makes sense. I said it.
Now, you're well aware that others have opposing viewpoints as yours, and that seems to bother you not one bit.
No, it doesn't make it. Those are just, there's always people you can educate. So I'm very, very happy to have them be confused and disagree right now, and perhaps I'll get the opportunity to sit down with them someday and explain why they're wrong.
So in addition to using this as an opportunity to teach them and influence them, it seems like you also use it to demonstrate that you're the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah.
Is this a fair assessment?
No, I'm never trying to demonstrate that. I don't even know how smart I am. It's not important. I just know that a lot of times I don't know things. I just don't know things. So you'll hear me say, I don't know, I'm not really sure, here are the factors, here's what we have to weigh, probably more than anybody other expert in the field. I don't know a lot of things. So I guess that's not smart, not to know a lot of things. But when I say something, when I've analyzed something, when I've come up with an answer, and I've said it's an answer, and I say it's indisputably true, it's always indisputably true. There is no wiggle room there. When I say that cards speak should be the rule, and that the bets shouldn't matter, and only when you put bets in should it actually matter, that's an opinion. You know, there's no right or wrong to that. That's just an opinion. So we don't know who's right. I might tease and say I'm right about that, but we don't know for sure. It's just a matter of opinion. It's a matter of taste. It's a matter of convention. It's whatever works for people. Could be totally the wrong way to go because maybe people won't adapt to it as much as well as I think they will. But if I say something like players are raising way too much today in this so-called new poker, and I know that for a fact because I've analyzed it, so it doesn't make any sense, and it can only win if your opponents cooperate by playing just as nutty, then that's a fact. There's no argument there. You can argue that forever, and you're always going to be wrong because that's a fact. They're raising too much.
Mike, you mentioned that you're working on a new book. Do you have a time frame when that may be coming out and what that's about?
Yeah, I already announced it. It's coming out in 2013.
What? Okay.
Well, I announced it publicly. You're not following it. You can wait for it. Just 2013 will be here. It's been published.
And that's a fact, Richard. There's no debating that.
There's no denying it. I can show evidence that it's been announced for publication in 2013. So when is it going to be? Well, hopefully soon, Richard. Hopefully
okay.
Soon.
All right.
I usually miss my deadlines.
Yeah, but not by much.
will Avery be your publisher again?
I don't know. I haven't talked to him about this particular book, so we'll see.
All right. So I'm enjoying this conversation. We've been more than an hour. You can bail if you want to. I got another question if you have a few more minutes.
I have a few more minutes, sure.
Wonderful. One of your points on an article you recently posted on your website, PokerOne.com, is that it's smart to be erratic at the table. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's not just at poker, but in life. If you want to get your way, some people think the best leaders are those who are very predictable, very sensible, always mellow, and make calm, rational decisions. That doesn't turn out to be the most effective way of leading people. The trick is to be in step with that character most of the time, but erratic enough that people can't count on it. So, and that's not a good thing. I don't like being that kind of leader. I like to be the predictable, stable, certain kind. But actually, that kind of leadership tends to work a little bit better. In poker, being erratic works a little bit better because it allows you to make the most straightforward, predictable, and profitable decisions more of the time. But by being erratic, throwing in a few things, it sticks in people's mind. And therefore, a totally predictable strategy or does not tend to work nearly as well in terms of profit as one where people think you're a loose cannon. So the trick is to think, to make people think that you're a loose cannon without actually being a loose cannon. So that means choosing bizarre plays as little of the time as possible. I go into a game, I do the most ridiculous things sometimes. But I might budget just a few $100 in chips for bizarre plays, hoping that they'll bring back many thousands of dollars in chips. In advertising, we know advertising works. You use advertising on your show. So we know there's a reason for advertising. Well, there's a reason for advertising in poker, too. Well, being erratic in poker is advertising. That's what it is. It's saying, I'm going to get more benefit than the cost of this advertising. I know this advertisement is costing me money, but I'm going to get more business in return for what I'm doing. So like in old draw poker, I don't know how many of the listeners know how you play draw poker. It's the old roulette game in the movies. You have five cards, that's all you have. You can draw a few replacements, and then you have a card. Okay, so I would call an opener, whoever opened the pot, and you needed at least a pair of jacks or better to open by rules back then. I would just call. Opener would draw a certain number of cards. I would stand pat, which means I don't want any cards. And I have a total garbage hand, just total garbage, can't beat anything. Now the opener would check because I stood pat, so that indicates I have a straight or a flush or better. And I would just show my cards down. So I called his bet in order to do not, to just show down a garbage hand with no chance of winning. And everybody would look at that, and they'll scratch their heads, and they'll think, what the hell is that? That's straight. Why didn't you bet sometimes, they would say. Well, because the hand wasn't any good, I would say. But you called. And so now they're very confused. And yet they think this is silly. They think it's probably some kind of a ploy. Of course, it's too ridiculous, but it sticks in their mind. So I'm gambling. Let's say I called $20 on that pot. This is old days in Gardena. We weren't playing for that much money. So I threw away one $20 bet. That's about the cheapest advertisement you could get in that game, and yet it's a play that is going to stick in their mind. Now, that's non-stable play. That's about what the nature of your question. What are we doing here? Why are we doing that? We're doing it because if we play perfectly rationally all the time, we're not going to get as much money in the long run in terms of profit, because those are your customers out there. Your poker opponents are your customers. You want to make them like buying your product. And so your product is what? It's when you have a great hand, a strong hand, the can't be beat kind of hand. Okay, when you have that hand, you want as many calls as you possibly can get. You want the extra money. How do you get that extra money? You get it because you've done strange things previously.
Yeah, it strikes me as calling on that hand would be only something a mad genius would do.
Right. You could do it. You can do it too, you know.
Oh, well, that's true. Next time I play
only,
drop poker, I'm going to do.
Not only something a mad genius would do, it's something that, Bob or Richard can do, and you can do it again and again. And
well,
so
I agree, we could do
I
it.
I want you doing it. I want you out there doing it. Go do it.
Go forth and do it. Mike Carroll, this has been a really, really big pleasure to have you on the air. You're one of the icons.
I've enjoyed being with both of you, so you can skip the rest of that, and it doesn't have to go on the air. Just let's just say we enjoyed each other and leave it like that. And you can put that on the air.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Mike. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.